Hello, and welcome to episode 121 of Church and Main. Welcome to Church in Maine, the podcast that is at the intersection of faith and modern life. I am Dennis Sanders, your host, and happy December, happy Advent. So today we're going to be talking about transportation. And I've always been someone that has been interested in transportation. I guess that is par for the course. When you come from Michigan, when your parents both worked in the auto industry, you're going to be someone that's going to be interested in getting from point A to point B. And I'm fascinated by all types of transportation, by planes, trains, and automobiles. Yes, I did purposely do that. I love talking about things like mass transit and high-speed rail. The thing is, basically, if it has wheels, I'm interested in it. You know, I can remember as a kid, I was always by our long drives from Michigan to Louisiana to see relatives, but I just kind of also had a fascination with the interstate highway system. All of that is just, I'm really into transportation. And maybe at some point I could have been, interested in doing some type of engineering of some type, but that never happened. But, you know, one of the forms of wheels that I have been interested in that I did not mention is the bicycle. And I remember as a kid tooling around my neighborhood in the 1970s, I can remember being maybe 8 or 9 and, you know, going a block or two away from my, where I lived was, it was like encountering a whole new world. And as I got older and got into my teens, I started to bike farther and farther away. And I remember biking as far as the huge Buick City complex back in my hometown of Flint, Michigan. This was in the mid 80s. I had to be about 14, maybe. And it was to me, it was cool to be able to bike that far. Kind of bike around where my dad worked for a living. My mother, though, was not so crazy about me biking that far away, but, that's kind of what happens as a kid. But, you know, now I'm in my 50s and I'm realizing in some ways I need to get back into exercise after all the COVID years. So I'm looking at maybe hopefully at some point this winter, early spring, getting on a bike again and heading out on the road, exercising on two wheels. The interesting thing about the biking world of the 2020s is how different it is from the 1980s. If you go back to the 1980s, most people, they either biked, you know, for exercise or they were with something that kids did. That's not really the case anymore. I mean, those things still happen, but it's very different, especially where I live now in Minneapolis. Minneapolis, along with St. Paul, basically give Portland, Oregon a run for its money as America's most bikeable cities. Many people here in the Twin Cities like to bike to work, and they don't really let a little thing called winter stop them. Even during the long and very cold Minnesota winters, what you'll see are people on their bikes. They will be heading to their places of work. And usually what they do is they trade in their smaller bike tires for those really wide tires that help with traction in the snow and ice. They will continue to do that. And I think while America is nowhere near the Netherlands when it comes to biking, I think that for millions of Americans, biking has become a legitimate form of commuting. This has all made me think about, you know, how does making your way around the world on a bike different from driving a car? And how does riding a bike or even walking impact your Christian faith and the ministry of the local church? So my guest today is someone that is also interested in transportation, but he has taken his interest one step further to make it an issue of discipleship for him. Travis Norville is the pastor of Judson Baptist Church in Minneapolis. And about a decade ago, he decided to put his money where his mouth is, and he gave up his car and started getting around Minneapolis via bike, public transportation, or on foot. And when he did that, he started to really see the world and the neighborhood around his congregation in a very different way. And Travis has become an advocate for helping Christians in many ways get out of their cars at least once in a while and move around their world in a different mode of transportation to see what they might be missing, and especially around their church. Travis has written about his experiences in a book. He is the author of the book, Church on the Move, A Practical Guide for Ministry in the Community. And as I said, he talks about his story and also how you can become more familiar with the neighborhood around your church. And stay tuned in this podcast, because one of the reasons that I got to know a little bit about Travis, and I had known a little bit about him beforehand, but really got to know about him because he kind of became an unofficial kind of traffic person, bike traffic reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. And I think you'll enjoy hearing his tale about how that happened. So with all of that, let's listen to Travis Norville. Travis, thanks for taking the time to chat with me this morning.
Oh, thank you, Dennis, for having me. Thanks for the invite. Very glad to be here.
Great. So I think maybe the thing to start out with is that you have an interesting story about how you ended up kind of looking at the world from a kind of a different viewpoint instead of from a car, from public transportation and biking. This is an interesting subject for me. Transportation has always been a fascinating thing because I'm originally from Michigan, and both my parents worked for General Motors. So, I really am always fascinated about all different types of transportation. I mean, I definitely, because I'm from Michigan, I'm a car guy, but you know, biking, public transportation, trains, planes, I'm always fascinated by that. So I'd like to hear your story about how you kind of came to this kind of revelation of how to see things from a different perspective.
Yeah, sure. I'd be glad to. So about 10 years ago, it was in the middle of what we call in Minnesota a polar vortex, which should scare most people, and myself included. In the middle of all that, I had a car that I dearly loved. It was a Volkswagen. I bought it in New Orleans. I later learned that it was flooded during Katrina, so it was had some problems that wasn't on the title, but that's okay. I loved this car. It had heated seats. That was the one thing I really wanted. And you know, one day that the heater broke in it, and I'd poured all kinds of money into it, and I was like, you know, I'm tired of doing this. So that was a thing that was going on in my life. And then I preached a sermon on kind of really just a basic kind of social justice sermon. My daughter at the time was 11. She was listening, and I posed a question, you know, what are you willing to sacrifice so that others may experience joy? And I go to tell her goodnight, and I said, goodnight, Seneca, I'll see you in the morning. And Jesus said, hold on, Dad, you know, you asked in your sermon what others are willing to sacrifice so that some may experience joy. And I'm just curious, what are you going to sacrifice? And, you know, at that moment, I just felt like a complete phony to her. And my mouth went ashen. I didn't have an answer for her. And I just said, I don't know, but I'll tell you soon. So that night, I turned the dining room table into kind of a makeshift midlife crisis center, and had, you know, laptop and four or five notebooks and stuff. And I said, okay, I'd always wanted to ride my bike and take public transit and walk. But, you know, I'd tried several times, but couldn't really figure out how to do it. And so I spent that whole night just figuring it out. And so that morning and breakfast, I just say, hey, kids, I've got it. I'm going to sell the car, and I'm going to ride my bike and walk and take public transit. And they had this look of abject horror on their face, which they should have, thinking that this will affect them. But I said, no, this is just my deal, not yours. And they breathed a sigh of relief. And I said, we're still going to keep the van, so we'll be okay. So that started it. And from there, I just started walking and riding my bike and taking public transit. And it was a complete, you know, reorientation of life. I'm a liberal social gospel preacher. You know, that's my tradition. And I realized that I was hardly spending any time at all with the poor, with those with their backs against the wall, just people struggling to go get by in life. But you're on a bus, and that's who you're sitting with. And you hear their stories, and you hear their passions and joys and heartbreaks. It was just amazing. When I walked, I ended up finding my neighborhood that I didn't know existed. So, you know, I know houses now by smells. You know, I know which house is cooking, you know, Italian on Wednesdays, and which house is cooking curry on Thursdays. I mean, these things you just get to know. And on my bike, I just, you know, I realized, you know, a lot of people are trying to make it in life. By that, I mean, just, you know, they're struggling financially, and they're on a bike because that's all they can afford. And realizing that how can cities really lift these people up and more? And how can churches be more part of their lives? I mean, that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
So it probably helps to understand, what is the neighborhood like around your church? I'm familiar with it because we're both here in Minneapolis. But for people who aren't there, how would you describe the neighborhood?
Yeah, my neighbor, it's South Minneapolis, and this is a residential neighborhood. And I can cross about three or four different kind of economic zones, with houses that are very nice. And one, within a stone's throw of the church is the, you know, former ambassador to Morocco live. I can go in the other place. I can go 10 minutes in the other direction, and that's the site where George Floyd was murdered. If I go a little bit farther south, you know, I'm in kind of the lakes area, but there's lots of lakes here. I'm in lakes. I'm in six sections of town where everyone looks like me, you know, as a white cisgender male. But I can go just a little bit further and be in a totally place where hardly anybody looks like me. So I should say on one thing, where the church is located, it's a very stable, comfortable neighborhood. The neighborhoods around it, you know, are in transition, and they're full of wonderful people, but there's a lot of pain in them as well.
So how has do you think your ministry has changed by being able to take public transit or walking or taking the bike as opposed to driving?
Yeah. It made me a lot more focused. You know, I think most times as a pastor, I would think of my parish really as kind of like the Twin Cities, which it, you know, in some broader way it is. But I mean, that's a lot to take on for one church, you know. So by shrinking it down to really a parish size model, what I call a bikeable parish, which is about, you know, a 15-minute ride from my house to the church. And, you know, this is kind of in vogue in Europe, these 15 to 20 minute cities, this idea of neighborhoods. Well, that focuses where I am and who I'm coming in contact with, and really trying to get to know the neighborhood. And by doing this, I found out that you know, no one knows hardly anything about the church I serve. They don't even know it's here. I have people that live within just around the block. Perfect story I have is one of the persons who was the chair of the neighborhood association. I was having coffee with him and I asked him, what do you know about Judson Church? And he said, I love your yellow Adirondack chairs. And my thought was, well, that'd be great, but we don't have any chairs. We don't even have any grass at our church. And I realized he thought that we were the Episcopalian church about, you know, half a mile down the road. And, you know, for most times, I would love to be confused for an Episcopalian priest. But that wasn't, you know, this wasn't the case. So I realized that people don't know hardly anything about the church or who we are or what we're about. And walking the neighborhood and riding my bike in the neighborhood and taking public transit in my neighborhood at least put me in contact with people and having relationships with them that I wouldn't have had in a car. And I think that's really been the change. It's been more community focused. And I feel, you know, when I pray for the city of Minneapolis, I'm really praying for the people that I run into every day. And they're telling me what their stories are. And those really inform how our approach to ministry at this time.
So you talked about the fact that the church is not far from where George Floyd was murdered back in 2020. How did that event really, and because of, by that time you were, of course, that, you know, basically didn't have a car and all that. Mm-hmm. How did your approach to that event change from what could have been if you were still just had your second car?
Yeah. Again, it's all about the vulnerability and exposure part of it. So when George, and after George Floyd was murdered, and when we all got the word of it, you know, I just hopped on my bike and rode to 38th in Chicago, and start, you know, you met people instantly. And I would go probably, geez, I don't know, for months, it seemed like I went every day or at least, you know, 4 or 5 times a week. And what that enabled, how that kind of changed me and how it kind of changed the church. Again, it was relationships. You know, you started meeting people, you started hearing what needs were. And I was able to say, hey, there's, you know, to kind of coordinate with other churches that were providing really just basic needs, but also just doing some wonderful ministry work there. You could kind of direct and say, hey, there's a church over here that needs diapers. You know, that's what the community really needs right now. And you could put that word out and people got it. Or we knew that like Appetite for Change was really struggling and needed all the help they could. It's because they were providing meals, not only for people in need, but Appetite for Change at every protest, at every community event, they were there with grills, feeding people and just providing this space of wonderful hospitality. And I think we raised, you know, $20,000-$30,000, you know, just putting the word out that, you know, that this is going on. And on a bike, it just enabled me to get from A to B a lot quicker. You know, there were so many places that were, streets were blocked off. Protests were happening. The police had other places blocked off. But on a bike, I could kind of zigzag through all these places and get from A to B and talk to people and hear what was going on. And that was a big change. I could see that. And, you know, there would be, on a bike, I would pass people in cars, you know, because they just couldn't go anywhere in the city. There was so much clogging of traffic. But on a bike, I could kind of zip around and I could kind of fly under the radar. You know, I had my clerical collar on and no one really paid much attention to me. So, yeah.
And how do you think all of this, especially how, I mean, I think as the role of pastor, as leadership, is sometimes we're basically models of how people are obviously looking to us as role models. Has this had an effect on the congregation at Judson in any way, that have other people kind of joined in, or if not, maybe seen things from a different perspective?
Yeah, I think there's been several ways. You know, when I started this is my own apprehension as a leader. You know, I wasn't doing this so that other people would mimic it. You know, or I said, look, this is what I feel God's called me to do. It's not an indictment on you if you drive here or, you know, anything like that. And I kind of just left it as that to see how it would organically happen. And what did happen and what is happening, you know, on some Sunday mornings, there are quite a few bikes that are out there, or people will say, hey, I took the bus from this day and this was my story that I heard, or, hey, I'm starting to walk the neighborhood more. So, I mean, there is kind of that multiply effect of people doing it. But I think really about 2 years ago, I just thought to myself, I think I'm going to go all in with it. I'm just going to commit to this as not only just my thing, but how can this change the church's approach to the ministry that we're doing to be more community focused? You know, and I think that's been helpful for people to hear more stories about the neighborhood. And it gives us more of a sense of, okay, we're going to try to do things with the largest impact within the Kingfield neighborhood, and then hope that it kind of spreads and ripples out. And I think that kind of clarity has really helped people. I mean, the best example I can give is just, you know, a few weeks ago, we did a pie baking seminar. We told everybody it's the holiday season, and if you're intimidated by baking pies, we've got some church ladies that are going to teach you how to bake a pie. And, you know, we had about 20 people here. Only 4 were from the church and the rest were all from the neighborhood. So just that kind of thinking that before all of this, I don't know if we would have been thinking like that, but it's helping us.
And so one of the things also that I have heard a little bit about is, how do you use spaces that aren't always used throughout the week? And probably, obviously, there are lots of church buildings that aren't used out. The probably one other thing that isn't on the church property, isn't always used as much during the week, is the parking lot. So I'm kind of curious that you have an interesting story about how you're using that, or and kind of really kind of doing more than just having it as a space for cars.
You know, the funny part is we don't have a parking lot. You know, as a kind of a landlocked church, we don't have a parking lot.
Okay.
But my idea, the what I'm trying to encourage other people to do, if you don't have a parking lot, if you do have a parking lot, you know, change it into a church plaza. So it's not just there only for the temporary storage of automobiles. So if you know anything about Minneapolis, you know that we are kind of in Lutheran world, and there are some gigantic, you know, ELCA churches here, and they're doing great work, and I love them. I think they're great places. They have these gigantic parking lots, and I like to take pictures of the parking lots throughout the week just as an example to see this thing is hardly ever full. You know, maybe on a Sunday morning, they're full. Maybe if there's a large funeral, they're full. But the rest of the time, at the best, it's 25% full. So how can we use this space in more productive ways other than just thinking of it as just a place to store cars? And some examples I have, you know, why can't we bring back basketball courts for church parking lots? I grew up playing basketball in church parking lots. With biking, you know, rather than, how about a vacation Bible school? Also, how about a vacation bike school to help the people in the neighborhood, both young and old, learn how to ride bikes? It'd be a great way for to have an e-bikes on an e-bike expo, so people could figure out how to ride them. Just all kind of, you know, skills course for kids to be able to weave in and out of cones or something. There's all kinds of stuff laying around in churches that could be used as you know, obstacles to get around and move. I think of, you know, farmers markets, places. There's the Kingfield neighborhood farmers market has moved 3 or 4 times. You know, just, okay, where is there a church parking lot it could be housed in? It also is just growing food. You can grow food in a parking lot. You can take 2 spots with straw bale gardening. You can produce enough food in one summer to feed a family of 8. I think you're not really talking about giving up great amounts of space for that. And the one thing that people don't realize is that in most cities, church parking lots are kind of this free, like a free zone. By that, you have all these zoning requirements, usually within cities, that prevent new developments or new things. But in church parking lots, they have this weird autonomy that doesn't exist anywhere else in a city. And some churches are experimenting by taking tiny homes and putting them in their church parking lots and housing people that are experiencing homelessness. There's one church that's trying to just take homeless veterans and give them a place. And they are using their space in this way. They're doing maybe three or four, creating a little village. And then they're using the already existing infrastructure in a church. So for a shower or a community kitchen or the library as a study and communal gathering space. And then providing this, you know, kind of like living quarters and these tiny homes. And I think these are just fantastic ways to show that a parking lot can be a plaza, can be a place of life, and it can be a place of growth, both internally and externally, than just this place where people store a car for a few hours. And I think if we just start thinking about that, really there's an abundance of space that we have available, and how can we use that in a better way?
Yeah, you know, the China home, I think you might be talking about the settled ministry.
That's one of them, yes. Yeah.
And actually, where I work during the week is a Lutheran congregation in Forest Lake, mm-hmm. Which is an exurb of the Twin Cities that's trying to do that same thing. They have a big parking lot that they have more space than they could use. And I think that it's a great idea of using some of that for people who don't have a home and to have some homes. I wholeheartedly agree with that one. all the ideas, but especially that one.
You know, I find it, you know, there's a church, First United Methodist of Los Angeles, that sold their building and all they have is a parking lot. So every Sunday they haul out these tents and they have a church service out in the parking lot, and then they take the tents down and then they rent their parking lots out for the rest of the week. And then they're also using it for overnight. You know, a lot of people, they're living out of their cars now. And they are letting people come into their church parking lot, park there for the night, providing them free Wi-Fi, you know, a little bit of services of what they can, at least just also just a safe place, kind of protected space. So there's all kinds of things we could be thinking about.
Yeah. I don't think that probably would work in Minnesota, but...
No, yeah.
Los Angeles, yes.
Los Angeles, yes. They can let that happen, right? Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You'd have to wear lots and lots of parkas. So one of the questions also is, you know, this is, we kind of talk about this as from the context of urban churches. What about suburban or rural churches? How does this kind of whole thing work from that perspective?
Yeah, and that's a question that people have asked a lot, you know, in response. And I get that. I really wrote the book for small neighborhood urban churches. I mean, that was my focus. But I still think some of the things can apply. You know, when I was back home, I'm from West Virginia, and just for the heck of it, my mom lives in a small town, and the bus terminus is behind her house. So I wanted to see where could I take this bus to? I could take that bus for 52 miles from her house to the farthest point in Kanawha County for $2.50. And it would take me to all kinds of places. Now, that doesn't mean that every rural or small town place in America has this kind of bus system. But I'm like, okay, if this can happen in West Virginia, it can probably happen in a lot of other places as well. So what infrastructure is there and how can it be utilized? And the other part is that I know a lot of suburban churches and rural churches have vans, you know, have church vans. So why, if you don't have the public infrastructure there, why not use what you have? If you have a church van, why couldn't it be a public witness that a church van is going to go around and pick up as many members as it can on a Sunday morning? So at least nobody's riding alone, you know, to get to church. At least there's this somewhat of a communal feel that can happen. And I also find that in a lot of suburban churches, they have resources that urban churches don't have. I mean, they do have space. And, you know, the couple of places that you were talking about, parking lots. I mean, they usually have bigger parking lots than urban churches. And there could be some partnerships that develop between an urban church and a suburban church and even a rural church, you know, how can we think of ourselves not as just three separate churches, or maybe more than that, but just thinking of ourselves as one body with different members that you know, relates to their neighborhoods in different ways, but can use resources to help each other out. I think there's a potential that I think could be there. And I also go back to my hometown, you know, St. Albans, West Virginia, maybe 10,000 people. But, you know, there's a lot of self-contained communities, you know, in America, small towns that have grocery stores, post offices, maybe some kind of medical clinic, you know, that could in many ways be bikeable cities. And could help out with wealth. I mean, not with wealth, but with health. It maybe could generate a little bit of wealth, but taking away the expense of a car, that you could be maybe a little bit stronger of communities. So I think those are the parts where I think this idea could be a little bit more integrated into. But I'm in some ways I'm aspirational with this.
Do you think that there is also something that in people in churches, just even if they do, they're not going to give up their car, still just walk around their church for the heck of it? I mean,
yeah.
You know, is there something to be said about just getting out and walking, not doing anything special, but just getting to know the neighborhood?
Yeah. I think, you know, let's say that you drive to church 52 Sundays a year, and you're never going to stop that, right? I mean, there are people, and I'm sure, like in your congregation and other congregations that are listening, right? We have people that the church that they love is the only church that provides them community, and so they seek it out for what it provides for them. And you don't want to make anyone like that feel ostracized from that. But I think there is a great value in having people, you know, just walk your neighborhood as part of Sunday worship. One of the things during the pandemic, you know, we weren't meeting in person that much. So I would just say, hey, on Sunday at 11, we're going to meet at the church and we're going to do a bike ride around the neighborhood just to say hello. And I was surprised that people had just joined us on these bike rides. I've got an idea. This is another aspirational one that I just learned and I haven't had a chance to do it. But, you know, in the Episcopal Church, there's this Rogation Days. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where you're supposed to walk the parish, kind of the outline of the parish, walk the parish. And that was supposed to be a way to connect the parish and the kind of the farms that are on the outskirts of the city. Why couldn't, you know, urban churches, suburban, rural also have that same practice? You know, we're going to once a month, we're going to have a Rogation Day. We don't have to call it that. It can be whatever it is. We're just going to walk. Maybe we're going to 10 minutes in one direction. And then we're going to walk a circle around there. And just to see who we meet, who we engage. I would suggest this. A few years ago, there was a woman who painted these wonderful murals on garage doors in South Minneapolis. And we wanted to see them. So we had a map to walk through where they were. And walking on the alley as opposed to walking on a sidewalk, I couldn't get over the different way that people interacted with you. On a sidewalk, you know, you're knocking on somebody's door and they think that you're a do-gooder or you're trying to sell them something. But on the alleyway, people were just more engaged. I met more people in the alley than I ever have. And I had one person walk up to us, say, hey, what are y'all doing? And we told them what we were doing. They're like, hey, we just moved here. Can you tell me where the best spot to get ice cream is? And we told them, well, I really like this place. And someone said, I like this place. So it was it was just an interesting way to meet people, you know, in your neighborhood by walking in the alley as opposed to on the sidewalk.
Yeah, I do some walking in my own neighborhood in North Minneapolis, and it's mm-hmm. fascinating to sometimes go down the alley instead of mm-hmm. the sidewalk. It just, you see different things that you wouldn't normally see if you're just walking down the regular sidewalk.
And a lot of those are hidden, right? That people want to have privacy, and I understand that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something that growing up, we didn't have an alley, which is kind of a driveway into a garage. So mm-hmm. there's something I like about the alley that's a little bit different. It's a little bit more interesting than just
having a driveway.
Yeah, it's totally more interesting. Yeah.
So, one of the things that you have been known for, at least here locally, is that you kind of do, I guess, biking traffic reports for Minnesota Public Radio. How did that start?
Well, so last winter, I was reading a book by Catherine Hayhoe, you know, that climatologist. And I can't remember the title of the book right now, but it's a wonderful book, and I recommend everybody to read it. But she had this wonderful line is, for climate change, stop thinking of all the things that you can't do or can't be changed. Can you find one area where you can make a difference and offer someone an alternative? That maybe that's where you start. So I had that book. I had those lines in my head. And then I was listening to Minnesota Public Radio, and they were giving the traffic report, and it was, you know, 18-wheeler jackknife on the I-35, or there's a car fire at 280, you know, all these kind of things. And so on a whim, I just texted the personality, Kathy Werzer, and said, "Hey, Kathy, if I give you bike reports on what it's like on the bike lanes for the winter and sidewalks and stuff, would you tweet them out?" And she said, "Sure." I found out later that she thought it was just a lark and like whatever. And so we started doing it, and she started reading them, and the response was pretty amazing. People started to enjoy them, and then I realized I have to write these little, you know, I've got 280 characters to try to describe both the sidewalk, bike lane, and road conditions, but also try to make it just intriguing enough that someone who's not walking, biking, or riding would at least be aware of what's going on. So it became a kind of a challenge, a fun challenge to how to describe the way the snow was interacting with the road. And that happened. And then a couple of people picked it up, the idea that there's an article in MinnPost. And then I was doing a podcast about, this was right about the time the book was coming out too. And a guy from England was interviewing me, and he writes for Forbes magazine too. So then he did an article on Forbes magazine about it, which made this, you know, this ridiculous kind of, you know, thing that, you know, these little tweets, all of a sudden we got more exposure. And then I got all these emails suddenly from, I've tracked it down to three continents, you know, people wanting to know, how do you do a winter bike commute report for the radio? Hell, I don't know. I'm just goofing off. It's been a lot of fun. And I make no money for it. I mean, they don't even give me an NPR sticker or anything, but I know that we did make it into the, twice we've made it to the NPR pledge drive, you know? So I think it's fun. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, how has, one of the things I've known, living here, now for about 25 years, is how much this is truly a winter. People don't stop biking just because there's snow on the ground. they put on their bigger tires and just keep biking. It doesn't matter if it's 20 below, they're still doing that. What have you learned? What have been the challenges for you, biking during the wintertime?
Well, there's thousands of them, you know. You learn your limit about what you can and can't take. And for me, it's when I walk into the office or in a meeting or wherever, and I start talking to someone, and in my head, I sound normal. But to other people, they're like, "I can't understand a word you're saying." And I realize my jaw's frozen, and I'm just kind of, you know, everything's just a big mumble. So I'm slurring everything. So I'm like, okay, maybe I need to stop that. But, you know, I've learned more than anything is, you know, you got to move in the winter, right? And you got to figure out ways to get whatever vitamin D you can get it. And I find that, you know, there is kind of seasonal depression that happens here. And I've suffered with it too. So trying to do anything you can helps with that. And it's made me really appreciate, I mean, I loved winter before. I love it even more now. It just gets you out, exposes you to other people. And it's a great, you know, great conversation. I love it when a car pulls up to me and they roll their window down and the person starts having this conversation with you at the stoplight. And I use every opportunity as a little bit of evangelization, like, "Hey, you can get out on here too, if you thought, you know." So That, and the group of winter bikers, you meet them, you get to know them, and it's almost like you got a little bit of a camaraderie. And when you see each other out, it's more than just a, hey, how you doing? It's really kind of more of a Star Wars, you know, may the force be with you kind of nod that you give to each other. And I appreciate that.
So I think getting close to wrapping this up, but I'm kind of curious, as opposed to kind of other metro areas around the country, how do you see the Twin Cities when it comes to biking? You know, I think that there are obviously, I did a lot more biking when I was younger in the 80s and everything. And it seems like things have changed a lot. There's much more accommodations for bikes. But I'm kind of, from your standpoint, how does Minneapolis, St. Paul stack up to other metro areas when it comes to biking?
Yeah. You know, every time I go on a conference or anything, you know, first thing I do is try to find an REI, because you can rent bikes pretty cheap there. You know, get on a bike and see what the city's like. And I got to say, you know, I know that our rival here in Minneapolis is Portland, to try to see who's got more bikers. But I love Twin Cities as far as the infrastructure we have, the accommodations, like you say. I just think that we're ahead in a lot of other cities. And if you want to try to do this, I think this is the place to be. I was talking with a theologian the other day who's also a big transit person. And I asked her, you know, I got a sabbatical coming up. I'm like, where do you think I should be? You know, where should I go to study to figure out what we should do? And her response was, you got to stay where you're at. You know, you got to like really dive into the Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know, Hennepin and Ramsey County, because I think this is going to be the center of alternative transportation in North America. And here's, if you're going to try to figure out how churches can be more beneficial or be a part of this, she said, I think you just need to spend that sabbatical here trying to figure out what's going on. So I think that's a pretty big, you know, endorsement of kind of where we're at and what we have to offer.
That is.
And we have no hills. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that helps.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I would do well if it were San Francisco.
No, or Seattle, you know, I mean,
So that's interesting, because I was guessing maybe she was going to say Amsterdam, of course, because
right. I mean, that's a whole different ballgame. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that is true. That is a very whole different ballgame, but that is a ringing endorsement of the Twin Cities. So,
yeah. I mean, I did speak with a librarian at a seminary in Amsterdam, and I asked him, can you tell me about the way that churches are integrated into church? I mean, bicycles are integrated into church life. And his response was, I don't understand your question. So I asked him again. He was like, no, you don't understand. Like there is no separation. Like, you know, bicycle life is just part of who we are. It'd be really hard to try to separate it out from that. And I was like, okay, this is a whole new place we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have not been to Amsterdam. I'm curious to go.
Yeah. Same here.
So I, usually when I go abroad, again, because I'm a car guy, I'm always interested in what kind of cars and all that, but there I want to see what kind of the whole biking thing, just because it's such a fascinating how much they are into that and oriented. I mean, they actually have bike like freeways and all of that.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to visit and just learn from that.
And you know, there's surveys that come out that show that it's the happiest drivers in the world are in Amsterdam. I mean, you take so many people, because there's so many people that are off the road, either biking in a different way, they're walking or taking public transit. So the streets aren't really crowded. So it's a great place for people to drive, they say.
That is fascinating.
Yes, I find it fascinating too. But I'd love to go and figure that out. But yeah.
Well, Travis, thank you so much. This has been a great thing. We've been able to kind of talk about things I really like to talk about, which is transportation and churches. And I didn't think I could ever have an interview that would put those two things together. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Dennis. It's been delightful. I love this. Thanks.
All right. Take care.
You too.
So I hope that you enjoyed the episode, and there will be links to Travis's book in the show notes. Just wanted to, just before we go, to let people know or ask people to consider making a donation to support Church in Maine. It does, there is some cost in getting this up and online. And if you are someone that likes to hear this type of innovative content, consider making a donation. And you can do so by going to churchinmaine.org. And there is a link for to give a donation. I'm still kind of, as I said, our the podcast is now on Substack, and I'm, you know, trying to figure out if I want to do something to put some things behind paywall and all that stuff. And I, you know, I kind of go back and forth on that, but I do want to at least give people the option that if they want to give, they can. It's not necessary. You don't have to, and I'm not guilting people into not doing that. So, but if you would like to, that would be helpful and welcome. Thank you. Also, please consider subscribing. You can subscribe directly to it by going to churchinmaine.substack.com and subscribing to get it straight to you via email. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast app. That is a good way to not have to, you know, try to dig and find a podcast. And then also, finally, consider leaving a review. When you leave a review on your podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, that makes it easier for the algorithms to help people find this podcast. And would love to hopefully get the message of this podcast out to more people. If you can do that, that would be great. Thank you so much. Hopefully, there will be at least one or two more episodes before the year closes out. Still kind of working on that, but of course, the year is moving fast, and I also have my other duties as a pastor trying to get everything done during this time of the year. So I'm hoping that we can have something out, some new material out soon, just to let you know about that. So that is it for this episode of Church in Maine. I am Dennis Sanders, your host. Again, thank you so much for listening. That it means a lot. Take care, Godspeed, and I will see you very soon.